Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Travel Department. Experience travel the way it's meant to be. Fully guided and extraordinary.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to Sunday with Miriam. Well, today, the great Paul Brady is in studio, celebrating decades of his music, from folk to trad, from pop to good old rock and roll. Paul has been sorting through his archive. He's remastered and remixed some classics. He's dug out previously unreleased material, and he's also celebrating some of his amazing collaborations with artists like Carole King, Bonnie Raitt, Dolores O'Riordan and Andy Irvine, and also the songs he wrote that were picked up by the likes of Tina Turner. It's going to be released in a 4-CD compilation with lots of photos and scrapbook pieces from Paul's own collection of memorabilia, and it's called Paul Brady, The Archive. Paul Brady, good morning to you.
Good morning, Miriam. Nice to be here.
What a treat for me. Listen, where do we begin with your archive? There's just so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, I confuse myself sometimes. I've been into a lot of different kinds of music throughout my life, and I always find it easy to switch from one to the other. So that's why I suppose there is a big variety of stuff in the background that people have never heard, and that might show a little bit more about how a song that they're familiar with in the commercial world began in life in my own little studio.
So how did you decide what would make the cut or not for this? Because you've written so much, you've been involved in so many songs, you've covered lots. What did you decide should go in, and how?
Well, there were like a lot of collaborations I'd done with other artists that you know, they might have come out on their album and then never been heard before, and maybe even my fans had never heard it. So I was nice to include collaborations with artists, and also to do some live stuff. And but I think the meat of it all is the very earliest examples of how a song that maybe people are familiar with now, how it came about in the first place. It's funny in a way, you know, although sonically speaking, because I like did this in my home studio and I'm not a professional engineer and all, some of it sounds a little rough in the home demos, but sometimes the home demo holds a bit of excitement that when you actually get to the studio with all the pressures in there, you lose something in the studio. So sometimes the sound quality of the home demo is more than made up for by the excitement in the performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And did you put all periods, like from going right back to the Johnstons up to date, did you put all periods of your career in it?
Well, yes. Yeah, there's songs from the Johnstons, and there's songs that I started when I very first started writing, different versions of songs that people are familiar with. Stuff like Nothing But the Same Old Story comes in a totally different version. You know, there's 64 tracks on this, and there's a lot of stuff for people to get their head into, yeah.
Now, take me back to your very first guitar when you were just a young boy in Strabane in County Tyrone. Who bought you that first guitar?
Well, I got a guitar for Christmas of 1958. I was, 10 or 11? It was a Spanish guitar, an acoustic guitar. And there was nobody to teach the guitar in the town that I knew of. So I kind of started teaching myself. So ever since I have come up with unorthodox fingering for chords that other people look at me and they go, that's not how you play that, you know, and I go, well, that's the only way I knew how to do it. So I taught myself how to play the guitar. I play guitar with the right hand, but I'm born left-handed. So, I mean, that must have had some effect on my fluency on the guitar. But equally, I've ended up with a technique on the guitar which makes a sound that nobody else makes. So
now, your parents, I think Molly and Sean?
Yeah.
Both teachers?
Yeah.
Your dad was a bit of a performer, wasn't he?
Oh, he was, yes. He was a singer, but primarily an actor. And he, in the earlier years, when they moved to Strabane first, he was involved in producing reviews and things and doing one-man shows himself. And he became known in the Tyrone Donegal area as a great man to do a turn at an event, you know. When I was a child, I used to watch him doing his one-man shows, and he would do kind of common stuff like, you know, Dan McGrew or things like that, Robert Service monologues, you know. But whereas people who did the monologues would sort of just recite them and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, he would act out every single person in the story. He would act out different voices, and it was a total one-man show. And I watched him as a child, and when I started to write songs myself with storylines and characters in the songs, it was he I was watching in my mind when I was delivering the song myself on stage. I was trying to be him, yeah.
Were you a shy young guy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, music to me was my friend, you know, that never talked back and never bullied me.
Which is great. You loved Bundoran, didn't you? I think as a child you went on lots of holidays with your parents there.
Yeah, well, like my parents being teachers, they had the long summer holidays, and my father was originally from Sligo and my mother originally from Fermanagh. And Bundoran would have been a good meeting point for a lot of people from those counties back in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And that's where I developed my love of the water. I'm a bit of a water baby, and I still swim and snorkel and scuba dive. Yet, you know, to me, the water is a wonderful environment. Yeah.
Did you start gigging up there when you were young? I mean, and what kind of music would you have grown up with, even when you were in places like Bundoran?
Well, I mean, I was into what was happening on the radio at the time, the pop music that came in from Radio Luxembourg from the Beeb or from America. I hadn't even discovered traditional music at the time. I mean, I was aware it was there in the background, you know, and my mother and father would sing old songs and my uncle played the fiddle and stuff. But I, you know, because I was the age I was only into Little Richard and Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and all that kind of stuff. Ray Charles I loved as well. I was kind of in my mid to late teens when I first began to even become aware of traditional folk music. And I think I'd have to thank the Clancy Brothers for that.
Okay.
Because they came in from America having huge success there. And they kind of, I think, were at the start of the whole resurgence of Irish music in the mid-60s, yeah.
Now, being teachers, they believed in education. You went to that brilliant school, St. Columb's in Derry, which produced a lot of fine people. And then you got a scholarship to UCD, bright boy, obviously. What did you study in UCD?
Well, I studied... I didn't study. I was supposed to study Irish, French, Latin and archaeology.
And?
Within about 2 months of... I mean, I never should have been at university. I mean, I was never deigned to be an academic. I never felt comfortable there. I felt out of my depth. And within a couple of months of me arriving in Dublin for the first time in October 64, I was going to gigs at night. And there was the beginnings of an upsurge in beat groups, which they were called at the time in Dublin, doing rhythm and blues. And I went to a concert in South Ann Street in a venue there. It was later called McGonigal's, but
oh yeah.
But and I saw my first collection of bands there, and I knew I had to get into a band, and that was the start. Yeah. My career as a student went down the tubes.
And how did it go down with your parents that it went down the tubes?
Well, it was difficult. It was very difficult. You know, they were both teachers, you know, and it was like, you know, the cliche phrase was, Paul, why don't you have something to fall back on? And, you know, you can't tell someone in their teens about falling backwards, because nobody in their teens thinks they're ever going to fall backwards, no. You know.
And your mom, she obviously just wants the best for you, but she... Did you have a tricky enough relationship with her or not?
I suppose I did. You know, it's either your father or your mother, I suppose. Mm. I suppose maybe I was like my mother too much. And we didn't have the easiest of relationships. I mean, she loved me and I loved her. But it was always a little bit of a struggle. Yeah. Mm.
When you went on to be hugely successful, did they get over the fact you left university? Did they say, OK, it worked out fine, you had something to fall back on?
Ah, yeah. Well, I mean, like, my mother was conflicted between the something to fall back on and her son being famous, you know. So once I appeared on the Late Late Show, things improved a lot.
That is so good. So talk to me about how you moved from rock and roll to folk to trad. You did the opposite, really, to Bob Dylan, didn't you?
Well, that's, I mean, then I went out the other end of the folk and trad into the, you know, writing my own songs for the first time. So I don't think it was the opposite to Bob Dylan. It was just a different timing in my life. I got into trad music from sort of 67 onwards up until 1970, 71. And then I started to hear artists like Jerry Rafferty. Mm-hmm. And I've said it before, but I'll say it again. When the first time I ever heard his song Baker Street on the radio, I just had to stop the car. And I knew that's what I wanted to do from then on, was to try and be a songwriter. So that's how I started writing the songs that eventually became my first album of my own songs, Hard Station, in 1981. And from then on, I've tried to keep in touch with all the forms of music I've loved.
Did you really sell your guitar to fill in it?
I did. Yeah, it was an electric guitar, a Fender Mustang, which I think it cost me 64 quid or something at the time, which was a lot of money in those days. But when I had to leave the rock and roll bands to pretend I was going back to college, I decided I'd buy an acoustic guitar and try and sing some folk music. And that's when I sold the guitar to Phil Lynott.
Did he pay you a lot of money for it?
Paid me some. He owed me a little bit. And never quite saw the full amount, but never mind.
Never mind. Listen, you've picked a first song today. We're going to hear from your time, I think, with the Johnstones. Introduce the song first, and then we'll talk about that band in a moment. I think it's Continental Trailways Bus.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the first songs I ever wrote. It was about the time the Johnstones spent in America in their last ditch attempts to try and break America, which didn't happen, of course. We were spending a lot of time traveling between New York, Boston and Philadelphia, trying to get ourselves noticed. And the song really reflects that time and the bus that we took to get us there.
Let's listen to it now, Continental Trailways Bus.
I remember all the days when I began to first get restless. Drank myself more than my share, trying hard to find a reason to continue locking up the legs inside my head. Trying hard to find excuses for my empty bed. Continental Trailways Bus, cruising into New York City. Now's the time to start again.
Love that song. And of course, the Johnstones, you were really successful abroad, Paul. Then you were invited to join Planxty. I know your dear friend Andy Irvine would have liked you to have joined his Sweeney's Men too.
Yeah.
So this was serious level trad. And I suppose that was your main focus, Paul, was it, through the 70s?
Well, yes, definitely until 78, when I did my first solo album. It was called Welcome Here, Kind Stranger. And that was, in a way, a total trad album. And when I'd finished that, it coincided with the fact that I was hearing artists like Jerry Rafferty. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly kind of felt, you know, I've said all I have to say here in the trad thing, and I still haven't discovered yet whether I can write songs. And that became the most important thing to me. You know, it's like I began to see myself as this long corridor with rooms on either side, and I'd been in the trad room, I'd been in the pop room. You know, was I ever going to get into a room where I wrote my own songs? And then was the time to do it, the end of the 70s. I started writing in 78, 79, put out my first single, Crazy Dreams, in 1980, and in 1981, my first album of my own songs came out. Yeah.
I mean, you drop in there, Crazy Dreams, like the first song. I mean, did you realise when you wrote that, by the way, how big it would be.
Absolutely not. No. In fact, one of the version that's on this archive is a totally different version to the one that people know now. It was the first recording of the song and was released as a single in November 1980. And I just thought it, because this archive is about stuff that's rare, that people haven't heard before. It's about home demos. It's about live stuff. It's about collaborations, one-off collaborations that were never really widely disseminated. So I just felt it was of interest to put on the very first recording of Crazy Dreams that many people have never heard.
Stunning Crazy Dreams. We're going to take a break. Join us in a few moments.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning with singer-songwriter Paul Brady. He's with me for a special look back at his career because he has compiled a four-disc set called Paul Brady Archive, coming out at the end of this week. Listen, before the break, Paul, we were talking about the 70s, the time you spent with Planxty, with Andy Irvine. Then you took another turn towards the charts. Was that because you were writing more and more songs?
Well, yeah. I mean, I wrote a lot of songs in the first decade of being a songwriter, I suppose, in total, somewhere between 250 and 300 songs. And that became the main focus of my work at the time, songwriting. And Irish music and trad music took a sort of a back seat at the time, I think necessarily, because I'd spent a couple of decades doing Irish music. And as I said, what I wanted to be was a songwriter now.
And of course, you were moving towards a more popular sound. Your fans knew what was happening. They didn't mind it at all. Sure, they didn't. So you could go from Arthur McBride, followed by something like we just heard before the break, Crazy Dreams.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way, I still do that, particularly when I'm doing solo concerts. You know, I like to sort of show the entire scope of my career and my interest in different types of music. And I still sing Arthur McBride, yeah.
Did you get any pushback at the time from, say, people in trad or folk circles about that?
Ach, yeah, but, you know, there's always people who want to push back, you know.
Yeah, everywhere in life. So listen, we're going to listen to another song now, the third one. I think it's called The Road to the Promised Land from Hard Station, I think.
Well, that's where it originally appeared. But about a decade later, as was the habit at the time, the record companies were always trying to issue remixes of things. So there was an album came out called Songs and Crazy Dreams, which was entire remixes of a lot of my previous recordings done by a different engineer, and they all sounded different to the original versions, and some of them stuck with me as being maybe even I preferred them more to the original version. And this is one of them, a song called The Road to the Promised Land.
To the Promised Land. Listen, I suppose at that time, Paul, you were getting serious airplay and these were big chart hits. How difficult was the music business to navigate?
Well, I found it very difficult because, probably because my breadth of material was too wide to be focused narrowly in terms of selling me as an artist. I mean, a lot of the questions were, who is Paul Brady? And I didn't even know who Paul Brady was either. But it's certainly, when you have a broad stylistic repertoire, it's harder for the marketing department to make sense of you and to sell you. And I found that quite a lot in the 80s when I was with major record labels. You know, they just didn't know what to do with me. And And I mean, also, I didn't look like a pop star. So I suppose, you know, whereas people in the company liked the music I made, they found it difficult to where to aim me.
Can they not just recognise genius when they see it in front of them? Everything you wrote, everything you could do.
Ach, well, I mean, I'm not sure it's about genius at all.
Well, we're not playing it today, but your song The Island is the work of a genius. Listen, I want to talk about collaborations, writing for and with other artists. Let's introduce The Havana Way for me and explain your Bonnie Raitt connection.
The Havana Way used to be called by me, and please don't ask me why, The Havana Way. When I first put it out, I thought it was too uncool to say The Havana Way. It's about, I'll tell you what it's about. I was doing a concert in York City in England, and there was the town was flooded out. In fact, we had to make our way to the venue in a boat. And I was in my hotel room feeling sorry for myself after that gig, and I decided I'd ring Bonnie Raitt in California. And she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm in New York. I'm, you know, this dreadful night, blah, blah, blah. Where are you?" She said, "Well, I'm going to Cuba, to Havana, to meet with a few musicians there." And I said, "When are you going to do that?" She says, "Oh, in a couple of months' time." And I said, "Can I come?" So she said, "Oh, of course, you know." So the song really is about the telephone call I had with Bonnie, my decision to go to Havana, and what happened when I was there. And as I say, the original version of this song was called The Havana Way, because for some reason I thought that's how Havana people pronounced their own city. I was wrong. but I've now decided this is mad. Change it to what it should always have been. So it's a remix and it's now called The Havana Way.
Your collaboration with the great Bonnie Raitt. And of course, your songs are picked up by so many other artists. Tina Turner, she did a cover of Steel Claw. How did that come about?
Well, that came about by accident. Like, most of what's happened to me in my career has been by accident. My manager at the time, a man called Ed Bicknell, was out at dinner one night with Tina Turner's new manager, Roger Davies. And Tina was making a new album. And Roger Davies knew that Ed Bicknell managed Dire Straits and an Irish singer called Paul Brady. And he sort of said, "Do you have any songs that might interest Tina?" So Ed had a copy of my own recording of the song Steel Claw, which was about Dublin in the early 80s. And he passed that on to Roger. And a couple of weeks later, I got a call from my publisher to say, "Tina loves the song and she's recorded it and it's going to be on the comeback album." But another month later, I get a call from the publisher to say, Roger Davies has decided that the album that they've just recorded sounds too dated. He's going to bin the entire album and start again. And I went, uh-oh. 6 months after that, when I'd forgotten about it entirely,
I got over it.
I got a phone call to say, "You know, Tina has re-recorded her brand new album. It's called now Private Dancer. And there's only one song she's kept from the previous album. And guess what? It's yours, Steel Claw." So I was back in the game.
How amazing.
And that's how the song got on Tina's album. And she recorded her version of it. She actually said, "Listen, I know this is about Dublin, you know, but nobody..." There was a mention in the song of Benidorm, where people go to on holidays from Dublin. And she said, "Nobody knows where Benidorm is in America, so can I make it about San Francisco?" And she did.
Great idea.
Yeah.
And of course, you got to know other great people like Eric Clapton, Mark Knopfler. Was it nice for you to get that recognition from your peers? I suppose you got to tour with Clapton. You got invited on stage with the great Rory Gallagher.
Yeah, well, look, you know, I was always delighted to be accepted by my fellow musicians, particularly the ones I admired. It made me feel legitimate and that I was part of it. It never particularly bothered me that I wasn't getting the same attention from the media or the press, because that comes with its downside too, and I didn't get the downside of it.
Mm.
So, but I was always delighted to be included by my fellow peers, yeah.
Now we're going to have another song. I want you to pick a cover now from the collection, Paul. You can pick the Beatles or the Stones, because you've got one of each in the collection, either Gimme Shelter or You Won't See Me. Which one are you going to go for?
I'll go for Gimme Shelter because there's a bit of a story to it. I had been writing songs with an American songwriter called Bob Teal. And in fact, a couple of songs that we'd written had appeared on my previous albums. And he, one day he called me up and he says, "Hey, I've just been made the music supervisor of this brand new American biker series called Sons of Anarchy. And, you know, we're now coming up to the end of season two and we're looking for a recording to finish that whole season. And we've picked the song Gimme Shelter by the Stones, but we'd love if you would sing it." And I said, yes, because I was a huge Stones fan. I was also a Beatles fan, but I was a huge Stones fan. And it was like a great, exciting thing to be offered. So they sent me a backing track that they'd made. And I sang the vocal in my own studio at home, overdubbed it, and a tin whistle on it, actually, and sent it back to them. And they loved it. And it became then the play-out song on the final episode of season two of The Sons of Anarchy, which was a huge series.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really weird to say this, but of all the hundreds of songs I've put out on record, my recording of Gimme Shelter on Spotify has been by far and away the most played thing I've ever done.
Isn't that amazing?
It's totally amazing.
Let's listen to it now. Gimme Shelter. Gimme Shelter there from you, Paul. Listen, stay with me. We'll be right back after this break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning with the legendary Paul Brady as we celebrate the release of his 4-CD archive collection called Paul Brady the Archive. It's also accompanied by a magnificent 60-page book. We're going to take another track now, Paul. Tell me about Let's Get Together.
Well, Let's Get Together came from a recording session. I was invited in 1999 to be one of a gathering of artists on a recording called Bleecker Street, Greenwich Village in the 60s, which was obviously a collection of hit songs from the early 60s in different versions. And I mean, I was excited to do it because, like, a lot of my favourite artists, like Curtis Stigers, Chrissie Hynde, Beth Nielsen Chapman, Suzzy and Maggie Roach were also on this album. And I was thrilled to be asked to do it. And again, it's I actually did this one in New York. Let's Get Together was a song which originally in the early 60s was a hit. It was written by Chet Powers, whose stage name was Dino Valente. And he had a hit with it, the first hit in the early 60s. And then it came out in the later 60s from a band called the Youngbloods. And the song was called Let's Get Together. It became a huge anthem in America in the 60s. And I always loved the song. So I got a chance to record it for this album. And this is it.
Make the angels cry.
all let's get together. Listen, you're gigging a lot. You're going to be, obviously, I'll give all the dates at the end, in Donegal and Vicar Street. Do you still enjoy gigging? Do you get the same buzz from standing up there in front of an audience as you always did with your guitar?
Well, when I'm on the stage in front of the audience, yes, I do get the same buzz, mostly. That's if the beast appears, you know, that's what I call the beast. This other person that invades me when I'm on a stage. Otherwise, I'm just Paul Brady, you know.
Do you like the beast?
Well, yes. It's great to feel that there's something else driving you when you're on a stage. But I have to say that the logistics of getting on stage get harder and harder with age and with, you know, stuff. So I don't so much like all the hoo-ha of getting on the stage, but once I'm on the stage, it still is where I ought to be.
Well, I've interviewed you for years. You look exactly the same. You don't age. Now, listen, you've been honoured along the way. Lifetime Achievement Awards, honorary degrees, the Ulysses Medal from UCD. Do those kind of things mean a lot to you? Is it nice that people appreciate what you do?
Ach, it is. It's great, yeah. You know. But I mean, I have a probably overly unhealthy degree of imposter syndrome, you know, which I've had to deal with all my life.
Still?
Yeah. I mean,
when are you going to get over it?
Well, I wonder, do you ever get over that? You know, yeah, of course, it's lovely to be given the nod, and I very much appreciate it. Yeah.
Because that's the amazing thing about you. You're always so modest. And also, I'm not surprised to hear you still suffer from imposter syndrome, because you're unbelievably successful. If you'd written one of those songs you've written, you'd be a success. Why do you think that is, that you remain as you are?
I don't know. I need to go to a shrink, I think.
Another J-Paul. What emotions has, I suppose, all this work on this fantastic archive brought up for you in terms, I suppose, of your legacy, your body of work? What are your proudest moments?
Well, you know, some of the more quieter songs, you know, the more intense emotional songs, you know, a song called Mother and Son stands out, which was actually a song about my relationship with my mother. And obviously, The Island is a song which, uncharacteristic for me, because I'm not really a political animal, and it was a song that kind of came out of me before I knew what was going on with it, you know. And even at the very end of trying to record the song, I was still trying to write the words, because I was confused about what I actually felt about things.
It's magnificent. It's my all-time favourite song. It's a poem, as Seamus Heaney said to me once. It's a beautiful poem.
Well, I'm a lucky man to have been around when it dropped from the sky.
And I know family is hugely important to you, especially your wife, Mary. Remind me how you first met Mary.
Well, I was back in Ireland from America, where I was still with the Johnstons group, although we were kind of falling apart at the time. I came back for Christmas of 1972, and I went back to Dublin in early January. And later that month, the great piper from Milltown Malby, Willie Clancy, passed away. And that was a huge thing in the trad world at the time, and loads of my friends said they were going to the funeral, and I really wanted to go too. So I took a lift down to the funeral. The night of the funeral, I found myself in Freel's pub in Milltown Malby, playing away with a load of other musicians, and in walked these two girls from Dublin. One of them stood out to me. Mary Elliott was her name, and we hit it off and fell in love, and eventually got married, and the rest is history. And I have to say, a couple of weeks ago was our 50th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
So I'm a lucky man to have met that lady.
You're very lucky. What's the secret to a long, happy marriage, Paul?
Compromise. I think, you know, well, first of all, love, but compromise, because we all know the cliche, you know, opposites attract but ultimately repel, you know. So there is that element there that you have to deal with all the time, and you have to work hard at keeping a relationship of 50 years together.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked hard.
Well, you both excelled at it. I suppose, finally, what is that stability and the security of having been able to make a living from music meant to you? Do you feel that you've had to work hard all your life, or can you now sit back, take it a bit easy and say, yeah, I'm good at this?
Well, you know, I can sit back, but I'm not happy sitting back. My concerts in April of 25 are the first gigs I've done since November of 24. And that's proved to be quite a long time. I start to twitch when I'm not on stage for a while. And okay, you may say it's a crisis of identity. You know, I mean, what are you if you're not a performer? But I'm afraid I am a performer as well as a writer. And I miss being that other person who's larger than life.
The beast.
The beast.
He's lurking.
Yeah, the beast. Oh dear.
Yeah.
There's an odd time the beast doesn't appear, you know, and you're left on stage, just being Paul Brady. I mean, that reminds me of the story of my son Colm, who used to always love dressing up as superheroes, and his uncle Des, Mary's brother, would come in every so often and say, "Who are you today, Colm?" And he'd say, "Oh, I'm Spider-Man today." Or I'm Superman today. And one day he came in and said, "Colm, who are you today?" And Colm said, "Only Colm."
I love it. It's like only Paul Brady.
Yeah.
Yeah, gorgeous story. We're going to end in another song, Paul, Nobody Knows. Tell me about this.
Well, this is a total remix of the song that has become popular over the years. Like when people are making albums, you know, there's all sorts of different mixes happen before the final one comes out. And this was a mix that happened about halfway through the recording process, done by the recording engineer, Wayne Yurgelin. I was making the album in Los Angeles. I think we'd got to New York by that stage when he was mixing. And I always liked the sound he made, but the record company preferred the one that now everybody knows. So when I came to this archive, I said, well, I was just going through all my old recordings. This one jumped out of the drawer at me. And I said, well, that's a different, it's a bigger sound, it's a wider space. And I'm as interested in music spatially and as musically. And I thought I liked this enough to put it on the archive.
Paul, thank you for being my guest this morning. I always feel very honoured to be in your company. So thank you for being my guest. And before we play out on Nobody Knows, I want to tell our listeners that Paul Brady, The Archive, is out this Friday, the 28th of March. And Paul, you're also going to be playing live on the 11th, 12th and 15th of April in Vicar Street and on the 13th of April in Mount Errigal Hotel in Donegal. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you very much. It's always nice talking to you.
Well, that is it for today. Remember, you can always find information on our show on rt.ie/Miriam, or you can listen back in the RT radio app. Today's programme was produced by Deirdre Ni Lyne. Elaine Conlon was our broadcast coordinator and Harry Buckless was on sound. We'll go out listening to Paul Brady and Nobody Knows.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Travel Department. Experience travel the way it's meant to be. Fully guided and extraordinary.